Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Pandora Scooter says she identifies as queer mama sapien and has been called the funniest, atheist, Amerasian, dyke, spoken word artist you'll ever see and hear, who speaks on behalf of misfits and fits of all walks and talks. Dubbed a spoken word rock star, Pandora has written 9 one-woman shows, performing in New York City, D.C., Boston, Birmingham, San Francisco, New Orleans, Austin, Atlanta. She's the founder of Stand Up and Stand Out Productions. Its goal? To provide inspiring, life-changing, and entertaining programming for the LGBTQ community. Pandora's most recent show, I Am Enough, tackles a very serious subject, suicide among LGBTQ youth. About 1,000 young people kill themselves every year, and she's working to get that number to zero by exploring and exposing their pain and building self-esteem and self-confidence. Her slogan, "You Are Enough." An artist in residence, Pandora has been teaching performing and writing in high schools along the East Coast for more than 20 years. Let's meet this force of nature. Pandora Scooter, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sandy. It's great to be here.
So, who's Pandora Scooter?
Pandora Scooter is a...
Is that your real name?
Yes. It's my real name, I know. I get asked that all the time.
Because if people were to Google you, they could find out that the latest model of a Pandora Scooter is on the market.
I do actually get a lot of spam email for Pandora, the jewelry. I get the Pandora, they have a scooter charm.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a lot of spam email for the Pandora scooter charm. And then also there is a scooter called the Pandora. So I get that as well. But no, that is my real name. My parents are extremely eclectic, eccentric people. They wanted me to have my own name. And so they gave that to me for various reasons. But Pandora Scooter, I'm an artist and I'm an activist. I'm an LGBTQ advocate. I'm a humanist, a feminist. I feel extremely passionately about introducing compassion into as many different niches of our lives as possible in order to make the world a better place. So
does it come from a very personal place for you?
It does. It does come from a very personal place. While my parents were very eccentric, one of the ways in which they were quite eccentric was that they lacked parenting skills of any kind and really lacked any ability to relate to me as a human being as I was growing up. And I felt quite rejected by them. And I think that having experienced that rejection for many, many years past 18 into my 20s and into my 30s, I realized that really, if we just showed more compassion for each other, the world would be a better place.
So is this from the Department of Not Everybody Should Be a Parent?
Yes. This is from the Department of Not Everybody Should Be a Parent. My parents definitely should not have been parents. And I saw that when I had a kid, and I saw the way that they related to her. And I saw that they really, and I had perspective at that point. I was much older, obviously, and I could see.
Were you an only child?
I was an only child, okay. Yes. I am the only child of an only child, and I have an only child.
Huh.
And we're all women. And I saw that my mother particularly, well, my father too, did not know how to relate to my kid and treated her as though she should have all of the abilities and skill sets of an adult when she was 3. And so it was very illuminating for me to see what I must have gone through when I was very young and why I have made it a crusade to introduce compassion and understanding and self-acceptance and self-love into my life and into the lives of everyone and anyone who will listen to me.
But you didn't know that things were different in your household, did you necessarily, when you were growing up?
I didn't know for a while, it's true. But I think by the time I got to high school and I started hanging out at my friends' houses and relating to their parents, I realized that there was a pretty significant difference. And also my friends would comment on my parents, their behavior as being aberrant or, you know, unconventional and, you know, abusive in some ways.
Wow.
So so that I got that kind of feedback when I got into high school and then got more of it in college. And amazingly, my parents are also extremely bright people, and I never wanted to give up on them. So I, you know, through my now almost 30 years of therapy, have dragged them kicking and screaming into what is mostly a healthy relationship with me. So, and they are two of my greatest supporters now, which is really fantastic.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a huge success story.
So who you are today in terms of your art is a real reflection on your growing up.
Completely. Even my artistic process is a reflection of my growing up, because my process when I was a child, I would write something and I would show it to my father, who's also a writer, albeit nonfiction, and I was writing fiction. And he would be highly critical of it, and there was never anything positive to be said. And my artistic process in writing, I flipped around. I teach creative writing, and I teach people to write from their hearts, whatever they want to write, and then embrace everything that they love about what they wrote, and everything that they don't love, forget about it. It's not a big deal. And then keep developing the things that they love and keep, you know, growing with what they love until they have something solid that they can develop. And that's a that's the opposite of what my father was doing, which was criticizing the things that he thought was didn't work and wanted me to, you know, fix them or get them right. And so I always felt that that process didn't work for me.
Well, it's not a math problem.
Yeah, it's true. It's not a math problem. It's not. Although I know some writers that see writing that way and work that way. And it just doesn't really work for me.
So why do you think you were drawn not to the writing part of this, but to the performance part of this?
I have to say that my...
And did you know you were creative?
I did not know I was creative. I didn't have that feedback from anybody. And I didn't know what I was doing was creative. What I can tell you is that I was in fourth grade and I was given a book report assignment, and I was dreading writing the book report. I thought it was going to be really boring. And so I went up to my teacher, Mrs. Most, at the time, and I asked her, I said, can I perform my book report instead of writing it?
You in the fourth grade?
In the fourth grade. And she said, sure. So I went home and I obviously had read my book, and I wrote out a script, which was basically my first one-woman show. And I made myself a laundry person. I was doing laundry, and I brought in a box with a top, and I opened the top like it was a washer. And I came in with a bunch of clothes that were dirty, you know, supposedly dirty clothes, and put them into the box, and then turned and saw my classmates sitting on the rug. And I said, oh, I didn't see you there. Oh, well, since you're here, while I'm doing laundry, I'll tell you about this book I just read. And then I did my book report, and then I finished it, and I got my laundry out, and I said, well, see you next time. And I walked off, and I actually continued to do my book reports that way, and I didn't have to write them. And
so it was just a very natural act for you.
It was
at 9 years old.
Extremely natural. And I still don't know. I've been very curious at times about what made me think I could do that.
Pull this off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had seen a fair amount of theater. My parents did want me to see some theater, so I had seen some theater. So I think maybe I had gotten the idea from that. But there's no particular performance that stands out that says you can get up a solo in front of people and just talk you know, and then instead of doing a book report, I had a lot of fun. I remember being very happy after doing that.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Pandora Scooter, who happens to be a spoken word artist. So how did you morph into that?
Well, I was an actor. And
oh, you were?
I am trained as an actor.
You went to school.
And I did. I went to school, SUNY Purchase for part of the time, and then Mason Grove School of the Arts for another part of the time. Got my master's degree and was also directing. And I was doing a lot of directing and enjoying it. Then I had my child. And directing is the kind of job that takes an inordinate amount of time and requires other people to be there, to work with other people to do it. And it's you can't direct by yourself. And I didn't like directing enough to give up time with my kid in order to direct. So I gave directing up and went back to writing, which I hadn't been doing for a while, for about 8 years or so. And the writing that I was doing was this kind of rhythmic, poetic writing that I thought would be really good if it was spoken instead of read. And so I started rehearsing, and all of this was stuff that I would put my kid to bed around 8 o'clock, and I would start writing and rehearsing from 8 or 9 o'clock, and then, you know, work until 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, and then hit the, you know, bed for 2 hours until she woke up, and then take care of her and take her to daycare, and then go to work, and, you know, do all of that that I was doing. And I ended up with all of these pieces that were spoken word pieces, and put together a show, invited some very close friends, got a studio in the city, and performed them. And it felt so good. And then I started doing open mics, and I immediately got huge positive reinforcement, got asked to do a CD, some performances, some feature spots in different parts of New Jersey. And it just took off from there.
Your performances were very personal.
They always have been, yeah.
So give me an example.
One of the pieces that I wrote when I was first starting out is called Epic Dyke Me. And it is about how I love the word dyke and I identify as a dyke, but dyke doesn't really cover all of who I am.
Let me interrupt and ask, when did you realize you were gay?
Oh, I came out when I was 29.
That's pretty old.
Yeah. I had actually some notions of it when I was much younger, around 15 and 16. I had some ideas and I kind of tried it out and stuck my toes in the water and got rejected pretty heavily. And because of all the other rejection in my life, I just wasn't able to stand the idea of being rejected for being gay.
Did you know that's what you were?
I just went into heavy denial. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, took a heavy dose of denial and held on to it as long as I could until it was not possible for me to hang on to it any longer. And then it just exploded mm-hmm. and I came out. So
that must have gone over like a lead balloon with your parents as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though actually, you were 29 and a parent yourself.
Yeah, actually, my parents didn't really care. They were pretty nonchalant about it. They were much more concerned about whether or not I was going to get divorced because I was married to my kid's father,
right,
my husband at the time. And they were much more concerned about that. And it wasn't until I was divorced and dating women and then bringing some women to meet my parents and things like that, that my mother would say things like, "Are you dating her?" And I would say, "Well, yeah, I am actually." And she'd say, "Oh, okay." So, you know, she was just, you know, very curt about it. And it's never really been much of an issue.
Okay, but it was very natural for you once
it was
once you turned that corner, so
extremely natural. Yeah, it took me about a year to deal with all of the identity crisis that came with, oh my gosh, I missed this for 29 years. What else did I miss about my life?
Uh-huh.
So it was about a year, and then I started dating, and it was just so smooth sailing. It was wonderful.
And so natural for you.
It was so natural. It was the most natural thing I've ever done.
So now go back to when I interrupted you about performing in connection with your sexuality.
I wrote a piece called Epic Dyke Me, which is about my identity and my identity going beyond being, quote unquote, just a dyke.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote that. I wrote a piece called Box, which is about having a box stuck inside me that's closed and locked and taunting me to open it, open it, open it, open it. And then my final strength to open it up, and it just blasts me with all of this self-knowledge, and I realize new things about myself, and I'm absolutely thrilled. And then I embrace this box, and it's got no more locks, and then I walk over to it to see what's inside of it, and I realize there's another box. But I won't quit,
mm-hmm.
is what I say.
Mm-hmm.
So
I want to hear a piece about the dyke performance.
I want to write me one of them, you know, one of them, you know, one of them. I'm a dyke, I'm a dyke, I'm a dyke, dyke, dyke. Poems, you know. The kind that gets up in my face so close you can taste the organic. What I wish I ate yesterday. So loud you don't know what to think. Pushed onto the what the brink as my strident words are spoken. But then I'd be an in-the-box token. A color within the lines. No broken lines between the 1, 2, 3. Connect the dots. Don't mix the stripes with the spots. Kinda dyke poet. But who is that, really? All this box label, keep it stable, is silly. Are you a top or a bottom, gay, straight, or bi? You're femme, butch or femme, us or them, coffee snob or math nerd, alpha male or alpha girl, moody or even keel, hippie or Navy SEAL, old school, new wave, or lipstick feminist? Are you a freedom fighter or are you a terrorist? Does any label we acquire describe everything we desire every day? Not for me. So I tell you, here's my haiku. Universe expands into what we do not know. So I do as well.
Wow. So I took away, what the hell difference does it matter who or what we are? Stop with the labels.
Yeah. I have a bunch of pieces that are kind of anti-labels. I mean, labels are fun. That's why I like to have fun with them and mm-hmm. use them. But
in terms of being defined by them?
Yeah, ultimately, what do you know about me? I'm a queer mama sapien. You know, I'm a human mama dyke. I'm a, you know, atheist. I'm, you know, progressive. I'm like, just because I'm progressive, do you think, you know something about me? You know, what
I'm
do you know?
I'm layered and textured and nuanced and these things.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you find that you needed to speak about your sexuality and this connection to the LGBT youth community? What's the outgrowth of that?
I feel that I do need to speak to the LGBT community because I feel very connected with the LGBTQICPA community.
What's ICPA?
It's intersexed, cisgendered, pansexual, asexual, and allies. So
I mean, we talk about labels.
Yeah, I know. I know. And they're, mm-hmm. they're.
I can't even spell LGBTQ.
I know. I do. I have a piece called Alphabet, which says, let's just turn LGBT into A to Z and take the whole alphabet. Let's just do it.
Yeah, right.
So I do feel very, it's the first real community that I've felt has embraced me. And so I feel that it's important for me to speak to them. But then ultimately, I don't see myself as pigeonholed just talking to LGBT people, youth and adults. I also want to be speaking to straight adults and straight youth. And I do, you know, ultimately speak to them. It just so happens that my show that I've written right now, I Am Enough.
Why did you write I Am Enough?
Two reasons. I wrote a piece called Outwardly Fabulous, which was 4 years ago, and it was in response to Tyler Clemente's suicide.
Uh-huh. Let's and just remind people about Tyler Clemente.
Tyler Clemente was the young man who went to school in New Jersey.
At Rutgers.
And Rutgers, and he was videotaped and live streamed having sex with another man and by his roommate. And then he found out about it. And when he found out about it, he drove up to the GW Bridge and jumped off of it and killed himself. In response to that horrific event, I wrote Outwardly Fabulous, which is a show about stopping bullying and stopping homophobia. And I toured that show along the into the Midwest and mostly down into the South, and performed it a bunch in New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania, also for high schools. So, which was really satisfying. But then I felt there was a component that was missing, because for me, the bullying was really not coming from outside. I mean, I felt it from my mother and from my father, but the bullying wasn't so much coming from the outside as it was coming from the inside. It was internalized bullying, and the bullying that was internalized was what was pushing me to want to kill myself. And so
you wanted to take your own life?
I did. I absolutely did. As a teen, I absolutely went through it and did attempt twice. So I attempted to kill myself twice and ended up in a mental hospital and learned and started the whole process of self-love and self-acceptance and getting rid of that bully that was in my head, so that I could embrace my life and feel good about being here. There was this element that was missing from Outwardly Fabulous, and so I decided that I would write I Am Enough, and it's a piece about suicide prevention and self-confidence building. I wrote it particularly for LGBTQ youth. However, I think it speaks to many more people than just that population. And it is the most autobiographical show that I've written thus far. Has everything to do with my story growing up and struggling with suicide and my attempts, and then how I got to a place where I learned that I am enough.
Is humor coupled with pain in your performances?
Yeah, it's coupled with pain. It's also coupled humor. There's a lot of humor around the taboo. There's
what taboo?
Well, you know, people think, well, I'm seeing a show about suicide. I can't laugh. It's not possible to laugh. And so I'll say there's a line in my show, I Am Enough, about how I have a failure resume, and the failure resume is about all the things that I've effed up to date, how I'm gay and not straight, and how, you know, I'm this, I'm not that, and I can't, you know, can't do all these things. And then one of the lines is 50 ways to mess up a relationship, 25 ways not to get a straight girl to flip. And everybody like kind of starts to laugh, and then they pull back
a little
because,
bit of a heh-heh-heh.
Right, exactly. And then I stop, and then I say, it's okay to laugh. I know it's a show about suicide, but we can laugh. Mm-hmm. And then everybody just laughs because they lets the air out. And then sometimes when people are coming in late, I'll say something like, I'll interrupt my performance and I'll say something like, oh, it's okay, don't worry, we're just talking about suicide. Just take a seat wherever you want. And so, you know, I like to let the air out, you know, wherever I can so that people can actually hear what I have to say.
So what you have to say is empowering young people, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. It's about their ability to make choices that embrace themselves and that have self-compassion and self-confidence, and to know also that they don't have to compete with anybody, that they are enough, and they can reach out to other people if they need help.
If you're just joining me, my guest today is Pandora Scooter, who is a spoken word artist and whose most recent show, I Am Enough, tackles this very serious subject of suicide among the LGBTQ youth community. So you're on the road.
Yes, I'm taking IMNF on the road, and I'm going to reach out to hopefully it looks like it's going to be approximately 1,000 LGBTQ and allies youth.
That will be on the receiving end of your performances.
Of my shows, uh-huh. Yeah. And I'll be at LGBT centers everywhere. I'll be posting all this information on my Twitter, which is Pandora Scooter, so people can follow what's going on and where we are on the tour. That's, you know, going to be a really, really intense experience.
But what else is it that you do when you perform? Because it's not exclusively about your own sexuality, is it?
No. It's not exclusively about my own sexuality at all. It's really, ultimately, what all of it's about is self-acceptance and kindness. You know, ultimately, you know, at its core, mm-hmm. it's, can I look at myself in the mirror, look myself dead in the eye and say, you're okay, kid. You know, you're doing okay. And, you know, I like you, and I can go to bed and with a clear conscience and be okay. You know, I think that's a lot of what it is. And a lot of that is having kindness towards myself when I, you know, mess things up or mm-hmm. make mistakes or, you know, don't rise to whatever occasion it is. And I think, you know, just I need to be able to be kind to myself and then kind to other people. I run an open mic. I've been running it for 12 years with my friend Steven, and it's called Out of the Box. And at the end of the night, we give thanks just to have closure. And then I tell everyone, be kind to yourselves. And if you have any left over, be kind to someone else because they probably need it.
You perform a lot for young people.
I do.
What about parents of children who may be gay, lesbian, transgender? What about, you know, people like your parents who could benefit from listening to you?
Yeah, I think my writing has been very much geared towards a younger audience. Parents, a lot of times when they do come to see my shows, I get a lot of responses like, I never thought of, you know, these issues the way that you're presenting them. You know, you've opened my eyes. It's really, you know, incredible. And it's like I'm another voice saying the same things their kids are saying, but because I'm an adult, it kind of resonates in a different way. So it seems to be a very positive thing. And I do perform for adults with their kids. And that goes really well, except that I think that sometimes the kids feel a little shut down, like listening to what I'm saying in front of their parents. Mm. So I think ideally I do a grown-up's parents show and then a youth show.
What does your daughter think of what you do?
My daughter thinks that I am doing very important work that she wishes weren't necessary. And she thinks that kids should know that they love themselves and that they should be brought up to know that they are loved and that they are wanted and they are enough. And I think she feels that she's wanted and she's loved and she loves herself and she is enough. And because my work takes me away from her, I think she's a little ambivalent about what I do. I mean, I think she thinks that it's great.
She's proud of you.
Yeah, she's proud of me. And I think she thinks it's great that I'm doing what I'm doing and that I reach, you know, people. And when I perform for her peers and they see me and they, you know, are, you know, really enthusiastic about what they see, she, you know, feels really good about that. And so I think she's definitely proud of me and she's happy that I'm doing the work that I'm doing. I think she just wishes it didn't take me away from her. But she's going to be 16 soon and she's taking good care of herself. And
well, she has a good role model.
Thank you.
We've run out of time.
Oh, my goodness.
I knew
Wow. You'd
say that, that there's plenty more to talk about. But you're a fascinating woman, Pandora Scooter.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
And I have really enjoyed getting to know you. We need more Pandoras.
Thank you, Sandy.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.